Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And I'm so glad you're here with us. I hate this part of the week. I hate this part of the week because I know it's almost over. And then I got to wait before I get to do this again. But at least we're ending on a strong note. This is going to be a really, really good hour. I've already gotten to meet Jeremy Christensen, our guest this hour. And what a wonderful, fine, engaging person. And your calls are welcome if you'd like to talk with him. He's the author of this book, From the Susquehanna to the Tiber, A Memoir of Conversion from Mormonism to the Roman Catholic Church. If you would like to talk about that, if that topic grabs you, if you'd like to get in on the conversation in any way at all, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jeremy grew up in a small Mormon town in Utah. You'll be surprised to hear that there are Mormon towns in Utah, perhaps, but apparently there are. He converted to Roman Catholicism just a few years ago, about 5 years ago, and he's a graduate of Southern Utah University, and he's got a law degree, and this book is a wonderful book. You should check it out, From the Susquehanna to the Tiber. Jeremy Christensen, thanks very much for being here with us for a Friday afternoon.
Thank you for having me on. It's good to be back.
We've spoken before on Catholic Answers Focus, our podcast. You should check that out. I was very engaged by that conversation. And I'll tell you something. This doesn't often happen with us, but the president of Catholic Answers, after that came out, came into my office and goes, "What a great conversation that was. That guy is fascinating." So I'm now I got you all built up for the hour.
Yeah, hopefully I don't disappoint.
No, you better not. Let me just put it that way. You better not. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. So what's it like growing up a Mormon in a little Mormon town in Utah? In some ways, it sounds kind of idyllic. I mean, Mormons are lovely people, and Utah is a lovely state.
Right. The first answer that came to my mind was, you know, not too bad. It is a great place to grow up, a very small town, maybe 3,000 people, give or take, a really tight-knit community. Probably 80% or more are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormon Church. My parents were very devout, still are very devout, and all of my siblings but one are still devout members of the LDS Church. My parents had seven children. And, you know, it's a great place. The LDS Church obviously instills really good family values. Family is very, very important. Our community was very strong. And the church is just sort of, the LDS Church is integrated into the way that I grew up. It's just a massive part of not just something that happened on Sunday, but socialization all of the time. Almost all of my neighbors were, you know, members of our congregation. And we would have youth activities during the week, multiple times during the week. And, you know, church on Sunday, which is at that time was 3 hours long. So it was an event. It was a good place to grow up. And, you know, my parents were, I think it's probably not too much different than growing up as a devout Catholic, you know, prayers every morning and every night. And we would read from the Book of Mormon every day as a family. And religion was a very important part of our life. Took it very seriously, not in a kind of like a weird way or an overbearing way. It was just kind of the way things were. And it was a good growing up.
So why did you leave it? Why did you come to the Catholic Church?
Yeah. So, you know, that was a long journey. I mean, I was born in the late 80s and was, you know, member to a devout family for a very, very long time. And I did, you know, I had some wild teenage years, pretty wild, in fact. But by the time I was about done with high school, I had kind of had my own personal conversion to Mormonism and was deeply, deeply convinced that it is true, that it is the one true restored church of Jesus Christ and led by a living prophet. And I did, you know, all the things I was supposed to do. I served a 2-year mission in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and came back, and I married a beautiful, wonderful young Mormon girl, and we were married, sealed for time and eternity in the Los Angeles, California temple. It's there on Santa Monica Boulevard. And we started our family, and we lived the kind of life my parents taught me how to live. And we were very involved and engaged in the LDS church and, you know, volunteered a whole lot. That is a big part of being a member of the LDS church, is that congregations are run completely by the local congregation. Everybody's a volunteer, and that's how you make things run. But it wasn't until I was in law school that I really started to kind of recognize, it's easier to recognize now in retrospect, but at the time started to have, you know, fissures in my faith come up. And they came from two different sources that conjoined at the same time. The one source was kind of in the greater Mormon atmosphere in, say, 2013, 14, 15. There was a lot going on in terms of accessibility to early Mormon history on the internet. A lot of reaction to that. You started to see all of these news stories about younger members of the church leaving the LDS church, and some of the high leadership sort of organizing events to kind of address it specifically. There were some high profile excommunications of a couple of people at the time, John DeLynn, Kate Kelly, who were kind of pretty prominent voices, questioning certain aspects of Mormon history or doctrine or teaching. And I mean, I think both of those were even reported in the New York Times. So there's sort of a lot of that going on, and you start to, become curious and kind of unpack and dig a little bit, like, what are these historical issues that people are talking about that have people so concerned? And one of the bigger things is that the LDS Church actually, I think, probably realized that the internet really had fundamentally changed its members' access to information that it didn't want those members to have. And reading about early Mormon history in sources that are, you know, not LDS Church approved became very easy. Yeah. And they tried to kind of deal with that by having, you know, church-employed scholars write essays that addressed a number of these topics. Oh. And that kind of made concessions for the first time in very public ways about things that were disconcerting, that you didn't really think a whole lot about, you know.
But they could. I want to stop you there, Jeremy, because I don't know that many Catholics know exactly what you're talking about, in that what is there in early Mormon history that would disturb someone like yourself, who was raised a Mormon, who was fully immersed, had done 2 years of mission? What's there that would bother you about being a Mormon?
A lot, actually. So, you know, part of it is that you are taught a very, or at least you were. I think I'll just bracket the point that the LDS Church is going through a lot of changes right now, and I think trying to deal with this. But in my growing up, you know, life and generations of Mormons before me, you were taught a very curated, particular history of the founding of the church, of Joseph Smith, of the things he did, of how the Book of Mormon was produced, of how, you know, all of these different events happened, and how the so-called restoration of the gospel occurred through the prophet Joseph Smith. And that is what your belief system is really rooted in, is this belief that he, you know, had a vision. Yeah. That he claimed in 1820, where he saw God the Father and Jesus Christ in this vision. And this is part of what, you know, revealed to him that God the Father has a physical body. It was this vision that he claimed occurred in the spring of 1820. And there's kind of an official version that is put in Mormon scripture of that account. And, well, you learn that actually in the historical record, there are like a dozen accounts of that event. Some of them, a handful of them, by Joseph Smith. You know, one of them, the earliest one, written in 1832, written in his own handwriting in a journal, that differs in the details in very, very significant ways about mm-hmm. that vision. There was God the Father wasn't there. He only saw the Lord. He wasn't told to restore any church. It was like a vision about him just getting personal forgiveness from Jesus. And it sort of goes on and on and on about how the Book of Mormon was produced. Its connection to folk magic, sort of frontier folk magic and treasure digging and treasure scrying that Joseph Smith was heavily involved in. All of these sorts of things that if you read, say, a standard scholarly account of the time period, you know, you would come away with, well, you might have some questions of how things happened, but you weren't going to come away thinking Joseph Smith was a prophet called by God to, you know, restore Christ's one true church. And, you know, there's a lot there. The polygamy, the practice of polygamy that Joseph Smith instituted in, you know, officially kind of beginning in the 1840s, but that he was having, you know, extramarital dalliances as early as 1836, when there wasn't also, you know, a theological framework in place for the concept of polygamy that he would later develop. All of these things sort of paint a picture, and it's never one thing, right? It's never, it's sort of the opportunity to, you know, go through and look and read a lot of this and then to see kind of a holistic totality, a different picture of those facts when you, it kind of clicks with you.
So you begin to be undermined in the idea that Joseph Smith was a prophet.
Yeah.
But what is he in your mind at this point? What do you begin to see him as?
At that point, so as I mentioned, there were kind of these two conjoining things. The one, you know, were sort of personal spiritual struggles.
Okay.
And the other, these historical problems. But when I read the historical stuff, it wasn't very long before I was like, whatever else he wasn't what I was taught.
Yeah.
Like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is not what it claims to be. I don't know what else it is. I you know, at this point, your entire sort of metaphysical, spiritual, moral rug is pulled out from under you. It's a very horrific experience that,
it's funny, it sounds like kind of the opposite of what Catholic apologists who are constantly telling people, you know, there's writing from the first century, you should read it. Like, you should read what Polycarp has to say. You should read what mm-hmm. Clement has to say. Like, these are things, and then people don't read it. Whereas you're saying in the Mormon church, it's more like, we'd rather you didn't read this stuff. We'd prefer you stay away from the earliest documents.
For sure, definitely. And that's because, you know, there's a funny question people will ask, what do Mormons believe? And, you know, frankly, the answer is really complicated because you could say, you know, there's a great historical book by a late scholar named D. Michael Quinn called Origins of Power, the Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power. And it's about the development, I don't want to use that word because that has a good meaning, a correct meaning in Catholicism and a meaning that's different in how I'm using it here. I would say the evolution of concepts of priestly authority and structure and the concept of the church in Mormonism through its earliest years. And the author makes this really, you know, poignant comment that it's not that there was like a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's more like that there are many churches of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because it went through such a heavy evolution of doctrinal belief, even contradictory, that it's hard to pin down to say, okay, well, what exactly do they believe? So you will have, for instance, a time, you know, when in the, say, the Utah period after the death of Joseph Smith, when Brigham Young, right, famous Brigham Young is in charge of the Mormon church in Utah when it's a territory. And he introduced a really radical idea that was actually really controversial, but was widely believed and taught for a long time, most of his presidency up through, you know, the late 1870s, was that he taught that Adam is God, that Adam is like the father of our spirits and our mortal bodies, and that you know, Mormonism has a complex cosmology of polytheism, of many gods, and that the you know, creation story is really about Adam, who has reached godhood, like coming down to earth to begin his spirit children who will worship him as God. And that obviously like doesn't even square with all of Mormon scripture, right?
Yeah.
But so it was controversial, but was widely believed and still is believed. You can see it because when the Mormon church broke off or cut short the practice of polygamy in the late 19th and early 20th century, and finally was like, we don't do polygamy anymore.
Yeah.
It caused a schism. And a group broke off. There are fundamentalists, right? Who still, Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and other groups that still to this day practice polygamy. And a lot of their beliefs reflect that earlier time period. And they believe this
Adam.
Adam that they call, in Mormonism, it's called the Adam God theory.
Jeremy, I got to take the break. So I'm going to do that, take the break. If you would like to get involved in this conversation, whether you're Mormon or Catholic or otherwise, if you'd like to know how someone comes from being a happy, well-adjusted Mormon child to a Mormon missionary, all the way out of Mormonism into the Roman Catholic Church, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. We'll continue our conversation with Jeremy Christensen, the author of From the Susquehanna to the Tiber, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hosting Women Made New has helped me deepen my own faith, and I look forward to every weekend having those in-depth discussions with my guests. It's been such a blessing being a part of the EWTN family and carry on the mission that Mother Angelica started.
Women Made New, Saturday noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I was just asking our guest, Jeremy Christensen, who grew up in a Mormon family and is now a Catholic, about the caffeine thing. And apparently that's somewhat controversial, too. Maybe we'll get to that, about whether Mormons can or cannot consume caffeine. The Church of the Latter-day Saints. One of the things that I learned from you in this book and from our previous conversation is that it's what we see today as Mormonism is not 19th century Mormonism, that this is a post-war phenomenon, or it's something else. Help me understand what Mormonism is today and where it came from.
Yeah. So Mormonism is rooted really interesting. I mean, somebody could make something really interesting out of this if they really studied it. But, you know, Mormonism is rooted in this concept of continuous revelation. So for Catholics, right, we believe that there's public revelation, private revelation, and the public revelation ended, you know, in the first century, and that the truth has been, you know, once delivered to all of us, and that private revelations may happen, but they're not, you know, altering the core message, the revelation of God in the person of Jesus. Mormonism, though, looks at the question and says, no, what happens is God is just sort of continuously changing things up, and he has a prophet, and that's the person he tells, you know, what needs to be happening for right now. And that even really, you know, gets down to like doctrine, if you really think about it. And so, you know, the Mormon Church has gone through a lot of different phases. Was sort of like a seeker movement, very spiritual gifts oriented, and frankly, kind of a Protestant offshoot in its very earliest iteration. And then it quickly changes into something quite different. And by the time you get to the 20th century, where the church finally kind of agrees with the United States government from a long continuous pressure campaign by the government that they will no longer practice polygamy, that was a huge part of their theology. And they kind of go on this thing where they assimilate a bit into American culture. And one of the really good illustrations of this is they move from the president of the church. You know, they all had beards at the time. Nothing against your beard, Si. They all had beards at the time. And then in the mid-50s, David O. McKay becomes the president of the LDS Church, and he looks like a 50s businessman. He has his bright, charismatic white shock of hair, clean shaven, and he often wears these white linen suits. And they kind of had a real big PR push. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir starts to go and like sing all over the country, and they're very good. They're very talented.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mormonism in this post polygamy era starts to really try and at once distinguish itself from other religions, because it's got to do its own thing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But they start to kind of take on a lot of traditional Protestant trappings to fit in, to assimilate in American culture. Because obviously, you know, being polygamous families with multiple wives, you know, out in the desert was not exactly like
didn't go big with the Baptists.
Right.
They weren't down for that.
Let alone like the main lines, right?
Yeah, right.
In the Northeast. So you know, they had that, and Mormonism really, you know, took off and became this sort of all-American, you know, all-American religion.
Right. Yeah, I remember, because I remember when I asked you about it, I said Mormonism seems to me like its roots are in a kind of congenial 19th century Americanism. And you said, well, actually, that comes a little later. That that's an affectation. I shouldn't say affectation, but that's a kind of persona that came later to Mormonism.
Yeah, yeah, and you know they've been. I think Mormonism's has proven itself to be a pretty nimble organization.
Yeah.
In its 200 or so years of existence. And I think that they are currently also on a trajectory where they are, you know, continuing to evolve, and their teachings will continue to evolve. I think that that's baked in, frankly, to the theology.
Well, it does. So the internet brought this whole ability of people to kind of look into the real Mormon history, and this created a crisis for many. That seems like that's what happened to you, created a crisis.
Yeah.
So I get the leaving Mormonism, because it does seem to me that what you came to was the conclusion Mormonism is not true, and has not told the truth about itself. But I, before I go to the calls, and I am going to go to calls because people want to talk to you about this stuff, and you're welcome to call if you want to get in on this, 888-318-7884. What brought you to the Catholic Church, though? Like I think many Mormons that have a similar story to yours, they just give up on religion altogether. I've noticed that phenomenon.
It is an alarmingly frequent occurrence that people who leave Mormonism, either become, you know, not affiliated with anything or become atheists. And I think part of that is the pain of it, to just like empathize with those people, because I've been there. It is a really awful thing, to have your whole worldview kind of ripped apart from you so painfully. It's really awful. And so at some level, I can empathize with the fact that a lot of people just say, like, my whole concept of God was wrapped up in this, so no thank you. my number one answer for why I became a Catholic or what drew me to Catholicism is God's grace, to just put it very simply, because it's nothing that I wasn't looking for. It's not what I set out to do. And it is seriously the last thing on earth I ever would have thought of doing, even at the time that I left the LDS Church. I wasn't looking to join another church. It was just, you know, these small kind of interactions of providence, right, through my life kind of led me ultimately to Catholicism.
We'll have to get the rest of the story after the break, because we got to take the break. Right back after this. Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God, and it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking with Jeremy Christensen, the very engaging author of a wonderful book, From the Susquehanna to the Tiber. It's his memoir of conversion from Mormonism to the Catholic Church. You're welcome to call and get in the conversation. I've said you can get in on the conversation, and I know I haven't gone to people yet, but I'm just going to finish letting Jeremy tell me why he ended up in the Catholic Church, and then it's going to be just caller, caller, caller after that, I promise. So by God's grace, you said, signs and intimations of Catholicism, and that's where we left it.
Yeah, so it really got off the ground when I stumbled across the church fathers, who were people I had not heard of, let alone read. And I heard about these people and just thought it was very interesting. Oh, who are the people who kind of lived earliest to Christianity outside of the New Testament? What do these people think? That's a very interesting group of people to you know, look at. And so I acquired those writings and just started reading them, and was just, it didn't take long to become intellectually convinced that whether Catholicism was true or not, whether it's like theological claims are true, that Catholicism is historically, as a fact, the thing that happened in the first century, the thing that came from the thing that Jesus and his apostles started doing.
Yeah. Right. And there's a continuity, then, in other words, with Jesus.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And that's why we want people to read those documents. And I think why a lot of people don't read them, because it's very hard to miss that Polycarp is of the same religion that John the Apostle was, and John the Apostle is of the same religion that Jesus founded.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There is this strong continuity, and that's what made me like, oh gosh, you know, I kind of still think of myself in Christian terms, but like, I don't believe all the things these people did. That seems like a problem. And that set me off to investigating. And, yeah. you know, I was drawn by a lot of things from there to join the church later.
Oh, we got a lot of people would like to talk with you. Do you mind if we go to the phones now, Jeremy?
Let's do it.
You've been putting it off as long as you can. It's time for you to get to work. Jeremy Christensen's our guest. The book is From the Susquehanna to the Tiber. It's by our good friends at Ignatius Press. Your call's welcome, 888-318-7884. We start in Murrieta, California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Is Cecil in Murrieta, California. Cecil, welcome. Go ahead with your question or comment for Jeremy Christensen.
Jeremy, I was wondering if you saw any parallels between Mormonism and I call it kind of an American version of Islam, because I am fascinated by the parallels. I mean, they're multiple. The manifest destiny economics sort of idea of how that was, you know, the polygamy, the ideas of the different levels of heaven, the God. I mean, the virgin
the sexual aspects, in other words. Yeah, there's yeah. very right.
Has anybody ever done a doctoral dissertation on the parallels? Because that, to me, it's like it's a fascinating. The little that I've dabbled in studying both of these religions. So I just was wondering what your thoughts are.
Yes. So the short answer, I would say I don't know if someone's done a doctoral dissertation on it. I would be completely shocked if someone hasn't written something. Maybe to your surprise, I would be shocked if a faithful Orthodox Mormon had not done comparisons between the two religions. Mormonism often will speak highly of Muhammad and sort of has a general speak highly of different faith traditions. But more concretely, yeah, there are a lot of parallels between Mormonism and Islam. Right. Joseph Smith claims that an angel of God that he says was named Moroni came to him and showed him where the golden plates were that he would use to translate the Book of Mormon. Obviously, that there's a lot of parallel there to Muhammad's claim that the angel Gabriel, you know, came and delivered the Quran to him. And, you know, the as you said, sort of the political kind of nature of the two. Joseph Smith obviously was a very capable organizer. By the time he was killed in the 1840s, you know, Nauvoo, Illinois was a very powerful city. It was huge that he had built up from pretty much nothing. And he had a lot of political power behind him, which is one of the things that was quite concerning to people around him. And so in those ways, and then obviously, as you point out, you know, the sexual ethics of Joseph Smith are at least in certain ways, you know, comparable to those of Islam in terms of polygamy and the like. Joseph Smith claimed that you know, he restored polygamy while he was doing retranslations of the Bible and thought, well, you know, these ancient patriarchs in the Bible practiced polygamy and prayed about it, and then God told him that was, you know, part of the fullness of the gospel and needed to be restored. So there really are a lot of parallels, and I would not be surprised if somebody has written quite a bit about them.
All right, Cecil?
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks very, very much. The polygamy is a quite notable parallel. Matt Fradd did a wonderful interview with an expert on Islam about that, and about how the importance of that actually in the original spread of Islam. I imagine that it would have a similar effect in Mormonism.
The one break, I would say, like the clearest, cleanest break is the, you know, Mormonism is not monotheistic. And certainly also does not have, you know, Islam has a rich tradition of sort of classical theism, of philosophical thought that has right. gone into its conception of the one God.
Yeah.
That is, you know, completely different than Mormonism.
Yeah. But it could be easily argued that much of that comes long after Muhammad, you know, Averroism.
Sure.
The philosophical kind of Islam comes long after Muhammad. Denise, thanks, Cecil, very, very much. Denise in Columbus, Georgia, watching on YouTube. We're glad you're here, Denise. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Jeremy Christensen.
I'm just curious because when growing up, my favorite group was the Osmonds, who are very Mormon, but they were always such a clean-cut family. I know my mother was probably happy.
Well, they were a little bit country, and they were a little bit rock and roll. You know, they.
Yes. So you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, right.
The screener was like the Osmonds, and I was like, yes.
Oh, that's Siobhan. Anybody, you cannot trust this younger generation to know fine music like the Osmond. But okay.
Well, I just felt them very, very inspirational, and I mean, and I'm a cradle Catholic, so I'm very happy with my religion. But I felt like they had something, too, to keep together as a family.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
It does. Let's get a reaction from Jeremy.
Yeah, you know, the Osmonds, obviously, yeah, they are a famous, you know, famous in their own right. They are also Mormon. Donny Osmond, I remember... I think the Osmonds' heyday was a little bit before my time, but Donny Osmond, you know, did Mulan and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat when I was young, and you know, those were big hits. We liked those in my house. They're fine people, and I think that goes to a greater point about Mormonism and Mormons. They're really good people. My parents taught me really, really good, strong family values, and Mormons do a lot better, frankly, than most everybody else in the United States at keeping family together. And they've been very, very good and successful at that. They have their own challenges in terms of, you know, divorce rates and those kinds of things. But I think certainly I try, even as someone who no longer is, you know, believes those things, to be as respectful as I can when I engage with Mormonism, because they're, you know, I have untold numbers of friends. My family, my wife's family, none of our family are Catholic. They're all Mormon, staunch Mormon, very devout and good people. So there are, you know, great Mormon people that we can look up to and we could admire, the commonalities that we have with Mormons. I think those are good things to build from. But you know, obviously where we're going to part ways are on, the doctrines and what's true and what God, intends for us and what he doesn't.
Denise?
Does
that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I just still, I have to admire the family.
Yeah, but
through hard times.
I think that's a good, strong Catholic and generally Christian instinct, too, is that we make a distinction between the person and whether or not a particular belief is true or not. And people always kind of act like that's not a real thing, or that that's not good enough or something. Like, you got to believe what other people believe. We get that a lot from people who are involved in very secular or the new sexual moralities, and where we say, we're not judging people. This is not about judging people. This is about what's true and what's false, what's right and what's wrong. And there's an awful lot of good that came from the Osmonds, particularly Marie.
Well, and for me here in the South,
yeah,
Southern Baptists do not like, I have been told I was going to hell because I was Catholic.
Yeah, that's not true.
To my face. And, well, I didn't believe it.
I'm glad to hear.
I was a young teenager going, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just feel like, you know, I just, you know, that family just seems so united. They just seem so good that...
I feel like you think we're going to give you free tickets to a Donny and Marie concert if you keep this up, Denise. We don't have any free tickets here.
No, I don't want to go see Donnie and Marie. My love was Jay, the drummer. Okay?
All right. Well, Denise, we got to go to a break. Yes, you're okay. Loving the Osmonds is a perfectly acceptable Catholic stance to take. We'll be right back with more with Jeremy Christensen, the author of From the Susquehanna to the Tiber, a memoir of conversion from Mormonism to the Roman Catholic Church, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Wherever you are in the world, you can access the EWTN Global Catholic Network. It's everywhere. You can get EWTN's great Catholic programming on your car radio, at home on your TV, computer, or smart speaker. With EWTN's app, you can take EWTN everywhere, on your phone or mobile device. If you want your news in print, turn to EWTN's paper of record, the National Catholic Register. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
I got to admit, the Osmonds got a little bit out there for me when Donnie started wearing purple socks. I feel like, you know what, sometimes you're just pushing the boundaries, and there's just no reason for that behavior. So, sure, they were wholesome, but come on, Donnie. That's some wild stuff, wearing purple socks. The numbers here is 888-318-7884. Our guest is Jeremy Christensen. His book is, which I hope is finding lots of success at Ignatius Press. It's called From the Susquehanna to the Tiber, a memoir of conversion from Mormonism to the Catholic Church. And one of the features of it, I must say, is a genuine affection for people who are Mormon and for people who are Catholic. There's nothing polemical in this book. It's a genuine and very affectionate memoir. On the line for Jeremy is Derek in Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Derek, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I worked with a Mormon and studied with him for a little bit, and he told me that they did not believe in Jesus as being God's son, that Jesus was the greatest angel ever made. And that's about it, I think.
So is that the case in Mormon belief? Is Jesus an angel?
No, they would say that Jesus is the Son of God, but when they say Jesus is the Son of God, they do not mean the same thing that Catholics mean when Catholics say that Jesus is the Son of God. That is, Mormons are not Trinitarian, and so, you know, to be theological about it, they would not say that Jesus is consubstantial with the Father. Rather, for Mormons, Jesus was created. So in that sense, it's sort of like Arianism, that Jesus was created by God the Father, and that all of us are spirit children of God, and that the oldest of those children is Jesus, that Jesus is the oldest spirit child of God. But he is also God, because again, for Mormons, they have a polytheistic religion in which there is more than one God, that so they don't draw the Trinitarian distinctions that Catholics and Orthodox Christians do. And so in some sense, from a Catholic perspective, you might say, yeah, the way they describe Jesus sounds like he's an angel, that he's like a created being that God made. But they, if you were to ask in my experience, they would affirm, they would say, no, Jesus is the Son of God. But we're all children of God in a very literal sense in Mormonism.
Derek, does that all make sense to you?
Yes, I have one more question, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. Go ahead.
Okay. Did you ever notice any miracles being performed in the LDS church?
So at the time I would have said yes, but only in the sense of, I think there's a fairly, you know, loose, understanding what's miraculous. Like, did I believe that I had prayers answered or that I saw people get healed? Yes, but not the way I would think about it now. For me to say that somebody was healed now, I would be talking about something very, very big, like inexplicable as to how that happened. For Mormonism, if someone, you know, says a prayer or a blessing of healing over someone who's sick, like you just ordinary sick, and they get better, like they will see it as a direct consequence of this healing blessing going on. So in that sort of sense, I would have seen that. But from now, as a Catholic, would I say I ever saw a miracle? No.
Derek, I'm going to leave it there because there are several other folks who would like to talk with Jeremy. I do want to recommend his book, From the Susquehanna to the Tiber, A Memoir of Conversion from Mormonism to the Roman Catholic Church. The name is Jeremy Christensen. The press is Ignatius Press. I'm going to go to Matthew now in Velton, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Matthew, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy, and hi, everybody. So I guess I had a question because I had a pretty similar story, although I stopped going to the Mormon church when I was like in my early teens. And I guess my question was, did you have to get rebaptized in the Catholic Church? Because later in my early 20s, I always had a pretty favorable opinion for the Catholic Church, and I ended up getting married to a girl that was also Catholic, and so I went through the classes and joined the Catholic Church, but they accepted my Mormon baptism, and I think I read something just the other day on the Catholic Answers app that said it didn't really count, and I was like, someone was going to talk to my priest about it. I was going to be like, do I need to get rebaptized? I mean, because
your biography probably covers a divide or a period of change in the Catholic view on Mormon baptism. Do you want to take that, Jeremy?
Yeah. So I am not an expert on the particulars of the church's canon law and its stance as to what it did before a certain period of time, what it did after a certain period of time. But as of today, I was rebaptized. So technically, I was not rebaptized because today the Catholic Church stance is that Mormon baptisms are not valid. So I had never been baptized, and I was baptized when I became Catholic. That's a consequence of a dubia that was submitted to the Vatican back in, I think, the early 2000s, when they responded that, you know, Mormon baptisms are not valid. But prior to that time, you know, I don't know how they were handled, and I don't know how quickly that message got out there after that was issued either.
Yeah, I think that was 2001. I may have the year wrong, but were you received into the Catholic Church before 2001, Matthew?
It was actually 2001. I'm 54 now, and I think it was 22, and so yeah. Well, no, actually, it was 91. Yeah, sorry about that. It's been a long,
I mean, if you have any,
long time.
I don't know the theology of this well, and I wouldn't like to pretend I do, but if you have any anxiety about it, you can just ask your bishop. You can call the bishop, tell him you were baptized or you were received into the Catholic Church, and you have a question about the validity of your Mormon baptism. Unless he's a terrible bishop, he'll respond to that question. So if you'd like any help with that, you can email us at radio@catholic.com and we'll help you get in touch with your bishop or whoever else you might need to get in touch with to know. But if you were received into the Catholic Church, I would have good confidence. But if you're worried about it, we'll help you with it. radio@catholic.com. Send us an email there. And I'm only moving because there are so many people who want to talk to Jeremy Christensen, the author of From the Susquehanna to the Tiber, a memoir of conversion from Mormonism to the Roman Catholic Church. And I want to go to Anne in Vancouver, Washington, listening on 88.3 in that's FM in Portland. Anne, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jeremy Christensen.
Yes, thank you. Several years ago, a neighbor told me that Mormon women are very stressed because they're told by their, I guess, their stake or their church that they have to do certain things. They have to be very involved in the church, or they have to take, serve in ministry, things like that. And what would your comment be on that?
Yeah. So I don't know that I could speak to, say, like general stress levels among LDS women or that I've seen like empirical studies or something. I will say that I alluded to this earlier. At the local level, like you mentioned, the stake, which would be something kind of akin to a diocese, and then a ward would be like a parish. But at that level, the Mormon Church is run by its rank and file members. They do not have a professional clergy except at the very, very top of the organization. And so a congregation runs every Sunday, everything, every activity, every youth group, all of it is being done voluntarily, except that members believe that the leader of, say, the ward, the bishop that they call, that he receives revelation to say, you know, God wants you to serve as the nursery leader, or God wants you to serve on such and such committee. And so they receive these callings and people, you know, accept them. And it is a lot of involvement and can be stressful, certainly. And you know, some people say it's pretty high demand. I think it is certainly more high demand in my experience than being Catholic. In that there can be pressure to participate, to help run all of these different things. But my own personal view is I don't judge that harshly, because it's actually one of the ways, while there can be some negative consequences from it, it's actually one of the reasons I think that Mormons have such high activity levels among their members and such strong commitment. So I think it kind of cuts both ways. But have I seen it contribute to stress of both men and women? Yes, it contributed in some really severe ways in my own life. So
thank you very much for the question. Can you say something about that, about the stress that you experienced yourself? What is the stress?
Yeah, so when I was in law school, sort of having this faith crisis time, I had been called as the elders quorum president of our ward. I was in charge of an immense amount of stuff, you know, mm-hmm. outside of attending law school every night, like taking care of people's temporal needs, visiting people who couldn't pay their rent, people who needed food, like... you're running a program where everyone has to visit every single family in the ward. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of people, conducting interviews with people, organizing classes. It's a ton of work. And, you know, I'm in law school. I had at that point like 3-4 very small children, and caused some burnout at that time.
That makes sense. Well, Jeremy, thanks very much. I really do appreciate it. It's not a topic we get to talk about all that much, but I'm very glad we have you to speak about it in such a reasoned and helpful way. I hope you will come back. I do want to recommend the book to people again, Jeremy Christensen's book, From the Susquehanna to the Tiber. It's from Ignatius Press, and it's a memoir of conversion from Mormonism to the Roman Catholic Church. Jeremy, will you do this again with us sometime?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to.
All right. That does it for us. Saddest moment of my week. Oh, that's all right. We'll be back at this soon. See you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.